Welcome to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination and our timeless connection to the land itself. Season 7, Episode 3, The Silver Wheel, as told by Jennifer Murphy. I'm so glad you're here with us today, Falcha. I'm your host, Marisa Gowdy, and my guest is Jen Murphy. She's an Irish mythologist, anthropologist, and founder of the Celtic Creatives. A Dubliner born and bred, from the time she could talk, Jen's grandmother, Frances O'Sullivan, filled her ears with tales from Irish myth and folklore, fueling a now 40-year fascination with the stories of her lineage. Jen's apprenticeship to following her soul's breadcrumbs has guided her formal studies in medieval Irish and Celtic studies, anthropology, and Jungian psychology. Jen supports people to remember that they have a shining soul, to dream Celtic spirituality into their modern lives by making the Celtic soul a living aesthetic, and by centering the soul in everyday experience of life through mythwork, dreamwork, and the body. So Jen, Falcha, I'm so happy to have you back. I'm so happy to hold space for your story today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here back again. Yeah, it's brilliant. Thanks a million, Marisa.
So as is our way on the podcast, what we do is ask the story to speak for itself first, and then we'll explore it together. So will you tell us the story today of the Silver Wheel?
I will indeed. So yes, let us begin. So answer might you know, a long, long time ago, in the kingdom of Gwynedd in the north of Wales, there lived a king called Math Fab Matanwy. And Math was, let's just say, an unusual king because he had a tinniad on him, what we might say a taboo, or in the Irish language, a gesh, where his feet always had to be on the lap of a virgin. Now, there was a caveat that if he, you know, was off going to war or battle, his feet could touch the earth. But outside of this, he needed a virgin footholder. Now, lucky for Matt, he had the most exquisite virgin footholder in Gowan. So Gowan was this, just this enlivening soul, a member of the court, and herself and Matt had a great relationship, which is a good thing because obviously they had to spend a lot of time together. Now, the thing about Gowan is because she was so radiant and magnetic, it wasn't just Matt's feet that fell upon her. Many, many eyes of the court fell upon her. And, you know, these included loving and lustful eyes. They included the eyes of Gylfaethoi, who was one of the sons of Dawn, the great mother goddess. And he had fallen in lust and love with Gowan. Now, he hadn't told anybody in the court, but his brother Gwydion, who was an incredible magician, it didn't take long for him to deduce that his brother had a wasting sickness. He was wasting away from his love of Gowan. And so Gwydion confronted his brother and said, you know, brother, tell me, what ails thee? And Gylfaethoi, you know, he was quite, because of his shame, you know, it took a while for him to give away that he was in love with Gowan. And so Gwydion said, listen, don't worry, brother, we'll find a solution to this. And the obvious solution that Gwydion came to was, well, let's just cause a war, right? Because if we cause a war, then Matt's going to have to get up, you know, put his feet in the soil off the virgin footholder and go to war, you know. And in these times that we are in, we know that wars are caused on whims. And so what happened was that Gwydion and an entourage traveled south to the kingdom of a king called Pryderi. Now, Pryderi is the son of Rhiannon, the beautiful Welsh goddess that we may associate with horses and all of these magical things. And hers is a story for another time. But when Gwydion and his entourage went down to Pryderi, Gwydion tried to do a bargain with Pryderi because Pryderi had these magical swine, right? These incredible, magical pigs, if you can imagine. I don't know what a magical pig looks like, but these pigs were really magical and really coveted because they were given to Pryderi from the other world, right? From the king of Annoon. And so what Gwydion did was he came along and he offered in exchange for these pigs the most incredible charger horses, right? So these 12 battle horses. And along with these battle horses, he offered these 12 massive greyhounds, right? These greyhounds that were black with like bright white bellies, and you know, their collars and their leashes were made of the most exquisite of gold. And he also offered Pryderi shields, you know, that were ornamented, and all of these, just basically these beautiful gifts. And eventually he convinced him to part with the pigs in exchange. So that deal was done, and you know, Gwydion started to travel back towards Gwynedd, travel up north, and with the magical swine in tow. And he said to his entourage that were riding with them, he said, "Listen, we have to move fast. We've only got one day to get back up north because, you know, those horses and those greyhounds and shields, I, you know, conjured them out of mushrooms, basically. And Pryderi is not going to be happy tomorrow when he finds that all of his magical things are actually mushrooms." So, of course, it came to pass, and Pryderi the next day is absolutely raging. He goes ballistic, and as prophesized or conjured more so by Gwydion, war ensues, right? So Matt has to get up. He has to go to war. And, you know, a terrible battle happens between the north and south. And eventually, actually, Pryderi is killed by Gwydion in battle. But meanwhile, while all of this, you know, is happening, it leaves an opening for Gylfaethoi to try and seduce Gawain, which, you know, she was not open to, and so he took her by force. And so when the battle ended and Matt returned to his kingdom and he met with Gawain, his beloved footholder, she said to him, "Seek another who can hold your feet." And he said, "Gawain, why would I seek another who can hold my feet?" And she told him what had happened. She told him about the treachery of Gylfaethoi and Gwydion, who happened to be his nephews, right? Because Math actually is the brother of the great goddess Dawn as well. So his first thing that he does in response, Math, is he says to Gawain, "Gawain, I will compensate you for the terrible crime that has been done for you, done to you." You know, as was the tradition of the time to compensate. And so what he does is he says, "I'll make you my wife, and you know, you can also have possession of my dominions," right? So first of all, he looks after Gawain, right? And secondly, he's like, "Where are those lads? Because I'm going to, you know, literally murder them." Now, they had been off, like, you know, meekly. They weren't like, you know, in the center of the court like they normally would, because they knew what was going to happen. But eventually they were summoned to the court by Matt. And Matt was also a wonderful, powerful magician. Okay. So Gwydion didn't lick it off the stones, right? It ran in the family, let's just say. And so when Gwydion and Gylfaethoi arrive in the court, Matt says, "I'm going to punish you for your treachery." And what he decides to do is he takes his wand and he turns his nephews into a pair of breeding animals. So he turns them into a stag and a hind, and then he banishes them out of the kingdom for a year. So they're off in the forest, and while they're on that year of, you know, exodus or exile, they breed a hind together. They return to the court, and Matt is delighted to see this hind, right? And, or sorry, this, they breed a fawn together, right? So the stag and the hind return together, and Matt is delighted to see this fawn, and he baptizes the fawn. But then he says, "Do you know what? The punishment isn't complete. There's more to go." And so what he does is he transforms, takes his wand again, and he transforms the nephews into a boar and a sow. Off they go again to the woods as these breeding animals. They return a year later with a piglet. Matt takes the piglet, baptizes it again, and says, "Nah, you know, we're not done yet." And he takes his wand, transforms them then into a wolf and a she-wolf. Off they go for another year, and they come back then with this fine cub. And upon that, Matt says, "Okay, the compensation is complete. You know, your punishment is complete." And he, much to their delight, transforms them back into their, I don't even know what it's say, human, but you know, let's just say human form. And so when they're the lads are transformed back, they're obviously delighted and eager to help their uncle, because Matt still has a problem. Like, you know, he just hasn't found anyone who can really fulfill the virgin footholder job in the same way as Gawain, right? He just hasn't found a substitute, or whatever word you want to use for Gawain. And so Gwydion, who's never short of a word or a thought, says, "What about my sister? You know, uncle, what about my sister? Maybe she can be your virgin footholder." His sister, Arianrhod, the Silver Wheel, the daughter of Dawn, Matt's niece. And so Arianrhod is then summoned from her fortress out in the sea to travel to the court. And there she meets her uncle. And her uncle asks Arianrhod, "Tell me, niece, are you a virgin?" And Arianrhod responds and says, "I know not other than what I am." And so in response, Matt says, "Well, I'm going to have my wand." You know, he basically takes his wand, and he has the wand floating upright in the middle of the court. And he asks Arianrhod to step over the wand to see if she is a virgin. And so she does it. She steps over the wand, and much to her surprise, and the surprise of the court and her uncle, a little baby drops from Arianrhod. This, well, maybe not a little baby, it's actually a real chubby little, you know, fleshy thing. And Matt is delighted. He picks up the baby, and you're not going to believe this, but he baptizes the baby, right? Because, you know, Matt, literally, all you have to do is look at Matt and you're getting baptized, right? So he baptizes the baby as Dylan, the son of the wave, and he sends Dylan out to sea. And it's said that, you know, a wave would never break under Dylan, right? So Dylan's happy out at sea, baptized, and you know, by his great uncle, I essentially, yeah, I think. But anyways, now while the distraction is happening with the baptism and all of that, another little lump of flesh falls from Arianrhod, and only Gwydion notices this. And Gwydion immediately swoops in, and he wraps this little lump of flesh in, you know, a velvet cloak, and he takes it and he puts it in a chest at the end of his bed. Now Arianrhod leaves the court that day, and she leaves the court in confusion. You know, we're not really told how she feels, but I imagine that she's feeling confused, as shocked as everyone else. And you know, many of us listening or watching this will be familiar with that sense of shame, the shame that attaches itself to you and that you have to carry with you, even though it doesn't belong to you. And so she goes back, you know, to her fortress in the sea and isn't heard from for a time. Now, a couple of weeks later after this, Gwydion is, you know, lazing about in bed one morning, having the rays pour upon him, and he hears this little mule, this little cry from the chest at the end of his bed, and he's perplexed. And so he goes over to the chest, having forgot about the little fleshy lump, and he opens the chest, and sure enough, there is a baby boy. So he scoops the baby boy up, and you know, he goes looking around the court for a nursemaid, right? Because the child desperately needs to be nursed. And he finds a nursemaid, and she begins to feed the baby. And the baby grows at an astonishing rate. Like, the thing is ginormous. Like, by the time, you know, it's a few months old, it looks like a 2-year-old. By the time it's two, it looks like a 4-year-old. By the time it's four, it looks like it's eight, and so on, right? So this child is growing at an astronomical rate. It is not a human child, let's just say. So Gwydion then really falls in love with this child and rears the child as his own until he feels that it's time for him to meet his mother. And so what he does is he takes the young lad and he travels out to Cair Arianrhod, right, to Arianrhod's fortress. And Arianrhod's fortress is in the direction of the west, right? In the direction of the west, in the sea, the plain of the setting sun, of dusk, of twilight, of night, under the realm of the silver wheel, the moon, you know, the moon, our first teller of time, the moon who enables us to navigate our becoming, right? The moon who changes her robes each night as the wheel turns. And so they travel out to, this lunar place, and they meet with Arianrhod. And when Gwydion introduces Arianrhod to her son, you know, he says, "This is your child, Arianrhod." Arianrhod immediately recoils, and she says, "Well, why do you seek to shame me, brother?" And Gwydion says, "Well, all that I ask is that you name this child, right? Because if you name this young lad, he can be initiated into life." And Arianrhod says, "I will not. I will absolutely not name him. And actually, I put a tinyet, a taboo upon him, that he will not receive a name unless it comes from me." Right? So no one can name the young lad unless it's Arianrhod. And so Gwydion is enraged, and he takes the young lad with him, goes back to the mainland, and obviously doesn't sit still very long, and conspires, you know, some trickery against his sister. And so what he does a few days later is he brings the young lad to the beach, and using his magic and, you know, taking the seaweeds and sedges, he creates a boat for the two of them, and also a big pile of what looks like cordovan, horse leather, right, out of the seaweeds and sedges. And they sail off then to Cair Arianrhod, disguised as shoemakers. So when they arrive at Cair Arianrhod, the gatekeeper says, "You know, well, who are you? Why are you here?" And they say, "Oh, we're here to make, you know, shoes for Arianrhod." And so one of her maidservants is sent out to, you know, get the size, like to share the size of Arianrhod's feet, you know, because when Arianrhod hears that the shoekeepers are here, or the shoemakers, she's delighted. And she's like, "Yeah, okay, I didn't plan this, but fine, I can do with a new pair of boots." And so the maidservant is sent out to share the size. But Gwydion intentionally first makes the shoes, I think, maybe too large, bit of a Goldilocks thing going on here, too large and then too small, so that Arianrhod is forced to come out and have her foot measured by the shoekeepers. So when she emerges from the fortress and they're, you know, there in the lapping boat, she notices the young lad, and, you know, they're all disguised as shoemakers, so she doesn't recognize him. But while she's looking upon him, he takes a slingshot and he aims it at a wren that has landed on the boat, and he hits the wren between its sinew and bone. And she's so astonished at the skill that he has, you know, to hit the bird at this point, that she calls out, "Bright one of the skillful hand." And with this, Gwydion says, "That will do, sister. Clue claw giffies. Bright one of the skillful hand, you have named your son." You know, Arianrhod is enraged when all of the magic disappears, and there's her brother, and, you know, this child who we now ha have a name from, for like this young man, Clue Claw Giffies. And she says, "Well, you know, he may be named, but he will not receive arms unless I give them to him." And so Gwydion says, "But then he can't be initiated into manhood." And she said, "I don't care. Go away from me. Go away from me, you and your treachery and your trickery." So Gwydion's raging again. There's a lot of rage in this tale. And so off he goes, sailing back, and, you know, maybe rests for about 5 minutes or so before he comes up with another idea. And this idea now is to, in the coming days, to disguise himself and Clue as the great bards of Glamorgan, right? So these amazing poet seers, these great bards, right? The two of them, And so they sail back out to Cair Arianrhod, to her great fortress, and they introduce themselves as the great bards of Glamorgan. And sure, the host is delighted. You know, the storytellers are here. Let's put on a feast, and the most sumptuous of feasts is put on. And, you know, they just have the best crack. And let me tell you, Gwydion was some storyteller. He was an incredible Shanachie. And, you know, myself and yourself, we would have loved to have witnessed his stories on that evening. So after the feasting and the entertainment was done and everyone was exhausted and they retired to their bed chambers, upon the fall of twilight, Gwydion got up and he started to work his magic. And he took his wand and he conjured into form the sound of shouts, of trumpets, of a fleet, you know, literally sailing out to sea, a big army. Like when Arianrhod woke up during all of the kerfuffle and looked out, she couldn't even see the sea, right? There were so many boats. And so she was in a panic because, you know, if there's one thing that Arianrhod did, is she protected her fortress and her people like a true sovereign. And that was her ultimate goal. And so she went around and she roused everybody, you know, to be ready for the fight. And she went to these bards of Glamorgan and knocked on the door and, you know, woke them up and said to them, you know, we're under siege, we're under attack, and we need your help. And Gwydion, in his disguise, said, of course we'll help you, Arianrhod. But you know, we don't actually have arms. And she says, oh, not to worry. Well, I'll arm you, you know. And with that, she provides himself and Clew with arms. And then once again, the magic dissipates. And, you know, Gwydion says, well, we're not going to need these arms now because there's literally no battle happened. I conjured this. And so again, Arianrhod is just like dumbfounded by the treachery of her brother. And so she says, I cast a tinned, right? Another tinned, a third one, that says that this child, you know, this young lad, Clew, will never have a wife of the race that now inhabits the earth, right? He cannot have a human wife. And Gwydion says, well, if he can't have a wife, he can't be initiated into kingship, right? He can't have his own kingdom, essentially. But, you know, Arianrhod is done, like just finished, Creignic. And so what happens then is Gwydion sails back with Clew to the fort of Mat and complains bitterly to his uncle. And so Matt thinks for a time about, you know, what to do about Arianrhod, all the tinnids, like how to work around this, you know, with Clew and get him a wife. And he says, do you know what, nephew? Do you know what we'll do? We'll just create a wife ourselves. Like, I mean, how hard can it be to create a woman? Like, come on. So they go out onto the land, and what they do with their wands and spells and incantations, they take oak, broom and meadowsweet, and they begin to invoke an otherworldly woman into form. And so they invoke, we beseech the spirit of the oak, the noble wood. To know you is to know magic, sacred groves conjuring mystery. From your acorn, a mighty tree, grow a woman in the image of thee. We cast the spell on the brightness of broom, bush of the wood, pubis of the goddess, wand of the bride, sprig of the bridegroom. Rod turned spine, branches turned veins, make yellow blood and a golden mane. We invoke the spirit of meadowsweet. The bride wore two dreams of becoming queen of the meadow. Intoxicate Clew's marriage mead with your sweetness. Death to your life in the wild, birth to your life as our flower bride. And with this, the otherworldly woman who becomes known as Bluddwed, Flower Face, Owl Woman, she opens her eyes. And this is where our story ends and Bluddwed's begins.
Jen, what a gorgeous ending. What a beautiful beginning. Sure, how hard is it to make a woman? How many times do you have to baptize anybody to get them to come round into the world? Oh, there's so much in this story, and thank you for making it so real. You know, it's one I know something of, but you just brought it alive in ways that just is so remarkable. I feel like I'm living it inside it with you. So thank you for this. Knotwork is a listener-supported show. And if these stories and conversations mean something to you, then becoming a paid subscriber to the Mythworkers Hearth over on Substack is the most direct way to keep the podcast going. As my thank you, paid subscribers receive Tourists, a series of special episodes that go deeper into the mythical, imaginal, and physical landscapes at the heart of this work. It's the journey within the journey. As a paid subscriber, you're also invited to join our monthly hearth gatherings, live storytelling, writing, and conversation with fellow myth-minded companions. You can find the link to subscribe to the Mythworkers Hearth in the show notes or visit us at mythworkers.com.
Oh, thank you so much. And it's, yeah, I mean, this story actually came in a very synchronistic way, you know, because it came through the studies that I'm doing, you know, in ecologies of the imagination, the Jungian studies, and myself and, you know, a wonderful Cara, a wonderful friend, Brooke, who is part of this course with me. We were to bring a story to our group together. And we had a completely different tale. And Brooke, you know, also has Irish and Welsh ancestry. She's based in New York. And obviously I am Irish. But I also have a little bit of Welsh ancestry, I will have you know. And so I'm fascinated by the Mabinogion. I feel like a Welsh ancestor, you know, just sailed across to the east of Ireland at some stage. And, you know, there we are now. And so we had a different tale, and then this just came in like a bolt, you know, and it was Bluidéod that ended up coming in. And how we worked with the tale then was that it just so happened that I did this part, which is the Arianrhod part, and, you know, Brooke did more of the Bluidéod part. And Arianrhod just took on a whole different form for me. You know, I still absolutely love Bluidéod and, you know, the connection to the flowers and the owl and all of that, because they are connected to Arianrhod, right? This lunar consciousness. But yeah, I began to actually really develop and deepen a relationship with her that is very, very nascent at this time. And yeah, it's just very exciting.
Well, recording this at the time of a new moon, so nascent feels like the perfect word, right? And just, you know, to speak into the synchronicities a little bit, you know, anyone who'll be listening to this in May, and, you know, we're recording this here in April, and, you know, we're being shaken by all the more ways in which it feels as if we are living in a man's world, in a dark world, and when there's so many aspects here that are redolent in your own story and resonant throughout. But also, the more, you know, personal synchronicity is, I just happened to share with you what I was doing for the first episode of the season and just happened to mention, oh, you know, we're working with, Robert's going to come on, we're going to work with Nulini Gonal's Bluidéod poem, and I'm just telling a little bit of it. It feels a little strange to be working into the Welsh tradition because I don't feel quite as grounded in it, of course. And you said, wait a minute, or I might think it might have happened in the opposite direction, where we both just recognized, from across the oceans and across the traditions and across time, we're in the same moment of story and tradition of story. And that it all feels so, again, to say, resonant to this exact moment when we're thinking about treatment of women, we're thinking about trickery, we're thinking about shame. I mean, what really caught me in the story too is the power of Arianrhod, but also the tenderness of Gawain. And just, you know, in many ways that she is victim in this story, but she's also, you know, seek another one who can hold your feet. Like, she's looking for solutions inside of her own You know, she's been trespassed against. She is the victim here, and she's still looking for solutions and ways to repair and keep things together. So, in the midst of all of these different synchronicities and all the tides that are crossing and crossing, and all of the different animals that are emerging and being conjured and being christened, and then all of the men and women emerging from this story, I just want to say thank you again for bringing it here. And casting it under the light of the silver wheel and the light of the moon and linking it into time in that way. Because I realize Ariane Red is associated with the silver moon, but that bit of the story is rather quick. It doesn't shine through as brightly. Could you say a little bit about kind of what the silver, did I say silver moon? I meant silver wheel. A little bit about that. I feel like that might be a beautiful place to begin.
So thank you for that reflection. And yeah, it's such a rich tale. And I mean, the dynamics in it are really, I mean, there's some brutal aspects to that story, you know, that are really resonant to our time and to the treatment of women. So I just want to presence that absolutely. And yeah, so the kind of the piece around the silver wheel, so Ariane Rod's name is thought to mean silver wheel. That's the most common translation. You know, Rod is wheel and Ariane is, you know, silver. And this is thought then to associate her with the moon. So it's more of a poetic connection as opposed to anything that the mythology is telling us. Now, I went down an absolute rabbit hole with this, because the wheel is actually a really important image within wider Celtic mythology and also within the psyche. You know, the wheel is an image that is both incredibly mundane, right? You know, like, look around the space that you're in and you'll find a wheel. Like, look out the window, a wheel of a bike, a wheel of a car, you know, a wheel of a clock, right? Wheels are everywhere. They're mundane. But the wheel is also a hugely archetypal image, right? The wheel of fortune, you know, the wheel of life, all of that. And within Irish tradition, we also have the Druid Mogrúth, who is the father actually of Cláchta. And he has a Like his name actually means devotee of the wheel. And he can also, like, he is given that name because it's said that he does wheel incantations. Right? We don't know what that means. So he does wheel incantations. And when he's doing his wheel incantations, he kind of flies up into the sky wearing his skin covering and his bird headdress, right? So associating him with the birds, and he does in his incantation. And interestingly, you know, within the other world, within Irish tradition, it's said that there exists an ancient tree on which the birds call forth the hours, right? So the birds are closer to the cosmos, so they're closer to the time. And then he's the wheel and embodying this bird energy, you know, this movement of time as well. So yeah, it's a really interesting image. And you know, when we look at, say, Ariane Rod, and if we are to look at the silver wheel as the moon, there is so much to explore here. You know, the moon is likely, like the birds, a very early measure of time for our ancestors, you know, and we even have, like, you know, all of the words from Greek and Latin and that relate as well, like the word menses to the moon and to the measurement of time, you know, to women's bodies as being a microcosm of the macrocosm of the moon. And the moon moves like a wheel, you know, it's robed in different clothes each night. And so it's a really strong archetypal image of our becoming. And that's what the wheel also is. If it's an image of the archetype of the self, of destiny, of fate, the moon symbolizes that in how the moon appears, you know, from like the balsamic moon, which may be the moon of Samhain, you know, waxing into the dark moon, which is, the winter solstice, the promise of life to come, into the crescent moon, the Imbolc energy, of the first illuminations, then, continuing on to the quarter moon when, we've got half dark and half light, like the equinox, and we have to decide what we're devoting ourselves to in our becoming, and then moving on then into the waxing gibbous at Bieltaine, the mouth of fire, as the fire gets higher by the time the summer solstice come, and we have the full moon, right? The full bloom. And then it begins to wane. It begins to disseminate. We have the disseminating moon, the harvest of Lunasa, as we then close down the energy and return through the waning of the autumn equinox to Samhain, and the cycle begins again. And this can happen for us every month if we so wish, But yeah, so there's a lot with the wheel.
Oh, what a beautiful invocation just of the cycles of all and drawing in the synchronicities and the ways in which, of course, the story is speaking to the moment and speaking to the everything. I can't help but think about the fact that we're still kind of basking in the Artemis mission and the people who went around the moon and sending back those messages. And it's funny, it didn't really register on my personal radar. I had my head down and I wasn't really checking much of anything, but hearing from women just needing to talk about it and just needing to say, hearing the voices come around on the, after, like, and literally one friend said she sat with the silence of the radio while the astronauts were on the other side of the moon and could not connect. And she literally sat and held that space. And she's a mystic and a poet. This was coming from the science of the soul rather than necessarily her interest in, interspatial aeronautics. And her then needing to come back and tell me about what it was to hold those four people as they came around and, to rename, the sea after Carol and all these different sort of bits of new lore that have been kind of cropping up. I think it's especially relevant for folks in the US right now, where we're just looking for things that are competent and beautiful coming from our country that we've managed a couple of things. And so I just want to hold that too to say it feels that the constant interweaving and fitchafuicha of how we understand these oldest stories and the timeless quality of the moon, and then where we are right now and what we're reaching for inside of ourselves and outside of ourselves just feels so potent. So thank you for that.
Thank you. And yeah, it really speaks to the timelessness of myths, that myths exist in the now. They exist in a realm that, where the birds call forth the hours, this timeless realm. And so they are always present and always journeying with us. And I guess it speaks then also to how stories choose us, that we don't choose stories. We might like to think that we do sometimes, but if a story wants to be told, it will be told and it will make itself told, and so I found myself telling this, and that was not, the original plan. Now, I had wanted to, for a couple of years, I've been really like, oh, I need to really want to spend some time with the Mabinogion and all of that. But there was an intelligence as well about when it came.
Yes. And in that same vein, and the sense in which stories tell us when it's time to be told, they'll also tell us, no, you cannot right now. This is not a story to come from your lips. And that is something I'm always thinking of when, you hear folks in our circles when we're working with people in their own healing and their own understanding of what they're trying to do here on this earth. Well, I was going to use this story. I was going to get this goddess to help me. And there's that little moment that I know I have within myself that says, wait, let's, without being the semantics police, let's also be aware of how much we're in relationship. And more often than not, if you're really attuning, it's the story that's more in charge than you are, in the sense that it is not necessarily a 50-50 relationship. It's much more tilted on the side of the myths and the tides and the moons and whatever being needs to come forth and be spoken into presence.
Absolutely. And it's kind of it's also when the story comes forth, it is kind of like that razor's edge. It's almost like a possession. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the difference I find in the energy of a story that I'm just sharing or a story that I'm living. You know, they're two different things. And like with Ariane Rod, she came through for me at a time when I've begun this creative project around creating this sunset journal. So it comes from this question of, and you've heard me ask this question before, like, what if you began your day at sunset, like our ancestors potentially did? And there's loads we can talk about that if the thread brings us to that about, well, what do you mean and why? But I have started to create this journal. And it's kind of like, I was thinking about the relationship between Ariane Rod and Clue in it kind of a different way than maybe, obvious in the tale. And what she has done for me is she has really initiated me into devotion to this project in a way that I am becoming it, right? So, like, for one, the Sunset Journal, like, for a number of years now, I've had so many different book projects, and been in conversations with agents and different things. And this Sunset Journal is almost like me receiving my name, in terms of an initiation to say, I need to make something matter, as in physical matter. I'm going to take it into my own hands through this guidance as well and co-creation with the ancestors, and almost telling myself, you can be an author yourself, make it matter, right? So that's kind of the naming piece. And then, the giving of arms or the refusal of the giving of arms, causes us to really do the research, to, find the tools to do the things. And then the marriage, piece, like with Clue, I feel is like the union, the initiation into finding the union, of the creative process with the authentic nature of me as the creatrix. And what I mean by that is, early on in this kind of, so I've been doing this ritual for probably about 5 years, and I do it with clients and in my community and all of that, right? And what this project and working with Ariane Rod kind of started to illuminate for me was, okay, you begin your day at sunset and you do this ritual a few times a week and all of that, right? But why are you still getting up at 5 a.m. in the morning, right? Trying to do both, right? And getting up early in the morning became a kind of solution to the lack of space in motherhood, right? That's it. And so if I got up early, even though I'm absolutely exhausted, then I'll have my own space to do my own, creative tending and rituals and all of that. And what was being illuminated to me was, let that go, because there was also an unconscious belief that, stemmed from years ago when I worked, as a leader basically in a humanitarian organization. And it was all like, remember the 5 a.m. club, get up early, be like super productive, have like your whole life sorted by the time you're not like 9 o'clock comes around, that was still lingering. I'm like, what? So what I did was I started to kind of really live into the fact that, for one, I have the night chronotype, not even like in the middle, like on the severe end. I know that from my DNA. I said it to my mother recently, and my mother was like, I don't know why you get up. You are never able to get up. I was one of those kids who would go to sleep in my school uniform so that I could just, pull off the covers and like go the next day. I was always a night owl. And just even symbolically, like, I was born at 10 past midnight, just before the winter solstice, on a waning gibbous, which is like the sunset of the moon. And my own moon astrologically is in the is in Leo in the 12th house, right? In the realm of the unconscious. So it's all this very dark energy. And so I gave it up. I gave up getting up and I devoted myself. And I'm doing a lot of the creation of this journal at nighttime with Ariane Rod. And it has been so liberating and I feel so well. And I'm almost like, how did I let that happen?
Wow. What a journey you just took us on. Like, what a story of sovereignty. You began and sort of naming that sense of your own creative process and looking for agents. And then I just kind of could hear so loudly that sense of, and then the ways in which you found your own agency by allowing the creative process to choose you and to shape you. And then kind of that rediscovery of your own sense of self and timing, which ends up being a really glorious and rebellious rejection of, patriarchal time and what's expected of us as, super productive of, getting it all done folk who also are at the whims of not only work calendars, but school calendars and children's needs and all of these different pieces. But such a radical sense of reclaiming and carving out for yourself within a family routine, because I feel like that's so often the quest of any modern mystic and any being who's just trying to find a way of being within the world and be doing this work and at the same time have 1.5 feet in the other world, or maybe sometimes it's only a toe, and how to kind of constantly be in that movement between the times. And I guess for me that it almost brings to another vision of the wheel, of that sense of as we're constantly turning, sometimes we are able to be so fully in that otherworldly creative spaces and in the twilights. And other times it's like, no, I'm in the heat of the day. I've got to get it all done. There's no way that I'm gonna, get the kids launched off to school or book the plane tickets to make it for myself to make it to Ireland, to be there in the, well, back in the mists in the creative time. And that happens, I think, according to our bigger year, but as you name, like according to our days as we live them. And, there's that sort of little truism of how we do one thing is how we do everything. But thank you for sort of lifting that up from thinking, if I rock my routine today, I'm going to rock my whole life in some ridiculous spoon-fed culture that we've inherited over the last maybe quarter century, and moving it in much more to this embrace of who we are and what is, and being responsive to sun and moon and rhythms of day and rhythms of year. Thank you.
It's made me more present to life as well, because sometimes, because of how I was, the culture I was brought up in, and the influence of the likes of my grandmother and all of that, like I would have a tendency sometimes to almost disassociate into the other world, right? To want to be in the other world more than this world. And that's also something that's happening in our times, right? Because our times are so painful to be in that the other world seems like, a place of refuge. And of course it is, but we are also born to be in this world. And Irish mythology is really clear about the consequences of spending too much time in the other world, like what we see in Chernanog or, Imran Bran or whatever it may be. And so being more in the world in my own magical way.
I'd love to linger with you a little bit more in this relationship with the other world, because it's such the focus of this particular season of the podcast. And, you are such a font of wisdom for me and inspiration. And I'm so appreciating what you're saying in terms of the, we know the reality of the Celtic otherworld, especially in the Irish tradition, and that the warnings of one does not stay there forever. And I find it's also interesting too, there seems to be kind of encoded in that sense of, if you think of Oisín or Nachtan in Bran's tale, that sense of one does get sick of perfection. And there's that sense of, homesickness, of longing, of needing to kind of put the feet upon the gray, flaggy shore after too much gold and too many apples and all of that. And so I feel for me, as I'm actually really, inviting folks to spend, the greater part of 2 seasons, we're going to go from Bealtaine to Samhain, like, and perhaps beyond, lingering in the other world and really sort of being on Tir na mBan, being on the Island of Women. And I'm at least at this point, I'm envisioning it as a tourist, as really like a tour of that landscape. And it feels both necessary and dangerous to invite folk to spend a longer period there. I don't see this as being a time of pure bliss and relaxation. Like, there is that sense of when you explore the landscape, it's hard, right? Whether you're climbing a mountain or you're going down into the cave or you're confronting of whose castle is this and what's it really doing here and why. So I know in my own way of what I'm seeing for this kind of creative vision, it is a sense of, or wherever you are, wherever you go, there you are, right? We're still taking with us our sense of this world and our concerns into the other world. But it is that sense of a shift of perspective that I think that we so need, not in order to escape and say, I'm just going to say, huh, I've got mine. I'm going to the beach. I've got just enough privilege and just enough savings in my account, and just few enough people need me that I could go and exit stage left for a while. And that's the furthest thing from my intention. And yet also, how do we step away enough to get breath? And, as you're naming it, it's that sense of stepping away from the dictates of the routine of saying, I'm going to claim my night owl beingness. And in this case, I'm hoping to sort of do a sense of how can we claim our otherworldliness and what it might be like to see the world through the perspective of women, because that certainly feels like a radical act. So I'd just love if you could just linger with me a little bit in here. So, and I just appreciate sitting with you so I can sort of name both my dreams and my worries about knowing what we're doing when we're playing with such a potent tradition. And I'd just love some of your thoughts.
Thank you for sharing that, and the nuances of it. And I guess, for me, like I would be really encouraging of people spending more time in the other world, right? Because it just so happens that my life almost took me in the reverse, okay? And that I have benefited massively from that, but I've also had some challenges in the waking reality, because of it. But there's one kind of way of seeing this that I think can really help. Well, there's many ways that can really help. But one way of framing it as well is, like our ancestors, the Éisteachán and the poet seers, the druids, the bards, and all of the people of the arts, right? They knew that we needed both sus, right? Waking time, scientific knowledge, learning the genealogies of place and so forth, and marrying it with imbas, wisdom that illuminates, which can only be accessed in the other world, right? In the darkened, the dark of night, in dream incubation, in, traveling to the other world, in creating those spaces. And that one cannot exist without the other. And you could not be a fella, a poet seer, if you were not skilled in both sus and imbas. So, for me, the image of sus and imbas is really helpful because it's not one without the other. It's both, and the marriage and the union of both. And, collectively, we are probably like 99% sus and 1% imbas. And then we try to hack the sus, like we're talking about there, like, well, I'm going to have my like incredible productive routine or get my shortcut to this, right? Because we're not even willing to do the long apprenticeship anymore, to the craft, right? Because everything's quick and, we're living in the realm of AI and all of that. So, yeah, I think like Emboss and sus are helpful anchor points for me around this, and just the like the necessity of both, if that's helpful.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is constantly that sense of being in relationship to the all is found by not necessarily getting stuck in either of the binaries, but recognizing that there are these poles and that we're moving between them and that there's distinction and yet that constant misting and blur in between.
And it's also like, like it's like that Joseph Campbell quote that I'm going to butcher now because I can't remember properly. I never remember quotes properly. But, around the goal is to make our nature match nature, and if you think about it, like within the Celtic tradition, like the other world emerges from the natural world, right? Because the natural world is magic. It's where the ancestors live. The fairy mounds, the land itself is alive. And I mean this in the sense of like not only the land that we can see, also the dreaming, right? The dreamingscape, all of it. That is all nature. Like, who makes the dream? And so if we can approach this of, a tourist to turn them on as well, of becoming more of our nature, of matching our nature with the nature of self, like capital S self, and also, of the ancestors, then yeah, Caudale Fager, what else is possible from that place?
Oh, Jen, there's so much possible when I get to sit down and speak with you. I'm so grateful for the gift of your stories and your insights. As we say farewell this time for now, can you maybe speak a little bit into the journal and how folks are going to be able to get their own copy as it's continuing to emerge? Because we're getting closer, right, to its emergence into the world.
We are getting closer, and I actually have a wonderful a former client and also a former classmate. We met actually. Her name is Steph. We met when we did Jungian psychology and art therapy together. She is my designer, and she's like, we are making this matter, like physical matter. And so I am now held to account and by Ariane Rod. So it is happening. And yeah, so at the moment, the plan is that it will be ready for Lunasa for the harvest season. And I have a wait list on my website. If anyone is interested, you can sign up on, you can just add your name to a mailing list. And as soon as the journal is ready, I will be in touch as well. I'll probably be in touch just before then. So yeah, by Lunasa, by the harvest season, it will be in the hands.
Oh, brilliant. And in the meantime, you are constantly conjuring up such magic over at Celtic Creatives over on Substack. So I hope folks will find you there. Are there any last messages or ideas coming up as we say farewell?
No, it's just, yeah, just thank you so much as always for the space. Like I do feel like we're in the other world here that we're already on Tiernanmon. So just, yeah, thank you for your beautiful bright dawn, your creative destiny that allows us, that opens the portal, opens the door, puts us in the boat, to go on our Imram or our tourist to the other world. So yeah, just buíochas Ó Cruí Isteach.
Thank you, Cuir Mhíle Maige, and thank you for being here today, Jen. I'm sure we'll do it again soon. Thank you for tuning in to Knot Work, Myth, and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. Want more knotwork in your life? Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, The Mythworker's Hearth, over on Substack. As a paid subscriber, you'll have access to the special new podcast series called Touras, which takes you even deeper into mythology, landscape, and the creative journey. And yes, that's a new name. You may know my newsletter as Myth is Medicine. It's now The Mythworker's Hearth. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. You can find out more about my writing, my book, The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, our online writing communities, including the Author's Knot, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach over at my website, marisagowdy.com. Music on the show is by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy, a Celtic fiddle and multi-instrumental duo based on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Find out about their music and shows at billyandbeth.com. My own work is inspired and sourced through a connection to my Irish ancestors. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Lenape, whose name means original people.